This is Hard Reset from BigIfTrue.org. You're listening to us on KXRW 99.9 FM, Vancouver, Washington.
I'm Justin Sanders in Houston, Texas.
And I'm Molly Bryant in Oklahoma City.
And I'm JC Cortez here in Vancouver. Today on the show, we'll talk about the role social media will play in the post-election day information storm as vote tallies change throughout November as mail-in votes arrive.
Also, a New York Post story potentially based on hacked materials is being heralded as an October surprise by the Trump campaign. We'll discuss the hard drive from hell, as Rudy Giuliani has labeled it, and the attempts by social media platforms like Twitter to stop the spread of the unverified claims made in the Post story.
But first, adjusting a life after prison has always been challenging, but it's gotten more complicated because of the pandemic. I spoke with Emma Castleberry. She's a freelance reporter and editor in Asheville, North Carolina. And last week she wrote for Big of True about what it's like to be released from prison during the pandemic. Here's our conversation. So, Emma, your story is about life after prison, but can you talk a little bit about what it's like in prison right now because of the coronavirus?
Yeah. So, the primary sensation I got from everyone I spoke to who had been released recently was just deep relief. They all felt very happy to be out of prison, which seems sort of like an obvious sensation, but I think that sensation was heightened now because overpopulation in prisons in the United States is an epidemic of its own. These spaces are extremely overcrowded, right? People are living in bunk beds where they're breathing the same air. They're, less than 6 feet apart. They're right on top of each other. And the risk of spreading the disease, of any disease, is very high. And a lot of prisons in the U.S. have been hotspots for the virus, meaning that they've had really concentrated high numbers of cases. It's been really concentrated in prisons. I know San Quentin in California was one of the early hotspots for coronavirus. So I think that people were just feeling, regardless of their circumstances, we're feeling happy and relieved to be able to protect themselves from COVID, which was not something they were able to do when they were in prison.
Yeah, so definitely relieved. But at the same time, like there was stuff that happened that, kind of complicated adjusting to life after prison. You spoke with a woman in Asheville, North Carolina, who left prison in July. And she couldn't get an appointment to get a driver's license until 2 months later. Can you explain kind of why that happened and why a driver's license is something that you need to have after leaving prison?
Yeah. So most people, some of this stuff does vary from state to state, but I think generally the people leave prison with a prison ID, which is, a card that says I'm a recently released inmate. And that form of identification is in many ways useless. People won't take it. And when you're applying for a job, you often need to prove your identity. And the way we do that in the United States is often with a driver's license. And if not with a driver's license, with a state identification card. And so accessing that is extremely important once you leave prison because it allows you to access certain resources. Having an ID is extremely important. And the struggle to get one, I was actually really surprised. I think for a lot of people, 2 months might not sound like that big of a deal. If you're trying to get your driver's license renewed, and two months might not sound like that much of a wait to some people. But when you don't have any form of identification, it's impossible to move in the world.
Yeah, and it's also pretty tough to get a job. So the person I mentioned earlier, she was able to get a job though without a license. What happened with that?
Yeah, so she got a job with Goodwill. And Goodwill Industries is known for working with recently released populations. They work with a lot of people who've been formerly incarcerated. And so they're willing to accept the prison ID as a form of identification. Before she got that job, she applied for a job at a convenience store, and they asked her for an ID, and they would not accept her prison ID as a form of identification, so she couldn't apply for the job. So yeah, there are, I mean, I think there are ways around it for sure. But, you know, Amanda Langford expressed, you know, she, the way she described her situation was as lucky. She was like, I'm lucky I got the job with Goodwill because, if I hadn't, I wouldn't have had a lot of options.
Another thing that came up in your story, and this happened to you, Amanda, as well, was people had trouble getting a place to live. Can you talk about the issues that came up for people leaving prison before the pandemic when it comes to housing and what has changed this year?
Yeah. So housing is a major component. Some people do leave prison and they have family members that they can move in with. That's a really idyllic situation. And relatively rare. When someone's been convicted of a crime, it bars them from certain public housing assistance. And that varies again from state to state. But often if you've got a drug charge or if you've had to register as a sex offender, you're no longer allowed to access public housing, which is a safety net for people who can't find a home. And so without that option, your choices are limited. You need to find someone to stay with. You need to either be able, and if you can't do that, you need to be able to afford your own place, which most people leaving prison have little or no money. You know, one advocate I talked to, she said, think of it as if I handed you, you know, $100, you had no credit, you had no rental history, and I told you that you needed to find an apartment in 30 days. Because furthermore, a lot of people, when they're released from prison, their parole is contingent on them finding housing. So not only do they need a safe, stable place to live for their own safety and comfort, but it's also, they could get put back into prison if they don't meet this requirement. So there's just a lot of stress and pressure around the housing issue and not a lot of avenues, not a lot of solutions available to people when they leave prison.
Yeah, and it sounded like some transitional housing places were less receptive to, you know, bringing on new people. Some property managers were, you know, kind of reluctant to rent to people who had left prison.
Since the pandemic, that's been particularly heightened. So even if you do qualify for public housing, say you don't have one of the charges that bars you from accessing that, the pandemic has presented, you know, people who are running these, you know, property managers in general, whether it's public housing or just an apartment complex, are concerned about bringing new people into their space right now. They you know, they feel that the safety of and health of their residents is important to them, and they are wary of accepting a new resident who could potentially be coming from a place where COVID was spreading rapidly. So the risk of spread of contracting the virus from another person is really, has really made property managers a lot more cautious about opening up new spots or offering new spots to people. And that has compounded the struggle for folks leaving prison. Amanda Langford experienced that. She tried really hard to get into a transitional housing facility, that a place that she couldn't get into because they weren't accepting new people because of the pandemic.
Everything has moved online this year. And in your story, you know, you noted that even support groups like Alcoholics Anonymous have moved online. So how has that impacted people who are, you know, returning to life after prison?
Yeah. So, well, first and foremost, relational work is really difficult, if not impossible, to do over Zoom or over the internet. You know, we're social creatures. And so support systems like Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, various support groups for people who are leaving prison and trying to reintegrate into society. It's just really difficult to get those, you know, human emotional components on the internet. But furthermore, when folks are leaving prison, they often, depending on the length of their stay, they often don't have the skills necessary to use these tools. They don't have familiarity with computers or the software we're using. And beyond that, they don't have access to these tools. You know, having a computer is a luxury. And particularly with a lot of libraries and public access points for the internet being closed because of COVID, people can't get on Zoom. They can't just hop on Zoom. And a lot of things, you know, even if they do have a phone, it might not be a smartphone. these, I think it's important to realize and to recognize that these tools, you know, computers, smartphones, are inherently, you know, a privilege to own and to have access to. And so folks leaving prison don't always have that. And so an online alternative is not always really an alternative for them.
I wanted to kind of go over a few things I learned from your story that aren't necessarily connected to COVID. But one thing I learned was, and this maybe should be obvious, but I didn't know this, being in prison ruins your credit. So can you explain why that's the case?
Yeah, so there's two kind of pathways to this. So say ideal situation, someone goes into prison and they have, you know, a sentence of several years and they've closed all their credit cards. They don't have an outstanding balance. They might have credit cards in their name, but they don't have late payments going on. In that scenario, which again is an ideal scenario, they're simply not. The way we build credit is we charge things to credit and we pay it off. And so when you're not doing that, your credit is being, it is, your credit score is lowering. So if you have a several year gap where you're not charging things to credit and then paying off your credit card, your credit suffers because of that. The more common scenario is that folks have an outstanding balance of some kind. They have, you know, couple hundred dollars on a credit card here or some outstanding late payments for a utility bill or something like that. And then they go into prison and they don't have an income. And so they're not paying off these bills or these late payments or these credit card balances. And that really damages their credit. So having, you know, overdue bills really damages one's credit. And so if you're in prison and you're unable to pay off those expenses, you leave prison with a much lower credit score and with a damaged credit background.
Another thing I learned was that there are certain types of public assistance that you can't get in certain states if you have, you know, a previous conviction on your record. And you mentioned the public housing thing earlier, but also food stamps.
Yeah. So food stamps, this was part of sort of the war on drugs, you know, many, many years back, that how they began to kind of really try to hone in on punishing people for drug offenses, particularly, you know, during the crack epidemic. And food stamps, if you've had a certain type of drug charge, you can no longer access food stamps ever. You're never allowed to access them. And some states have made, Ohio is one of them. Some states have made efforts to amend this and give people access to food stamps regardless of their charge. But it's really difficult to access food stamps if you have a certain type of drug charge on your record.
So we've talked a lot about problems, but one solution that was mentioned in your story involved, you know, using empty hotel rooms to, you know, kind of deal with some of this stuff. Can you talk about those programs?
Yeah, so I thought this was really innovative and interesting what they did in New York. New York partnered with Exodus Transitional Community, which is a nonprofit that works with reentry services. They work a lot with people coming home from prison. During the pandemic, when all of these hotels and motels were shut down because no one was traveling, you know, these people weren't, they were forced to be to close their doors. Exodus and New York combined forces to basically create, to turn these motels and hotels into transitional housing places where people could go after prison they could self-isolate in a hotel room. They had access to meals. The kitchen staff remained employed at these motels because they were cooking meals for the people who were living there. And so they basically just transformed these motels into public housing places for people who were leaving prison. And I just thought that was a really innovative strategy. And I think it speaks to, you know, it took some funds and it took some coordination. And I think it speaks to a real resourcefulness on the part of the state. And I know that there were other examples of that across the country, but I think that New York really, really stood out. And some of the advocates I talked to really, pushed for that model to be, you know, applied in other places.
Was there anything else that they kind of felt like should be changed policy-wise or program-wise?
I think one of the major things I heard was that there needs to be more funds allocated one way or another, whether at the state level or the federal level, for supporting specifically people who are leaving prison. Because often this group gets kind of lumped in to other marginalized groups, whether it's like people below the poverty level. But really this group is facing some pretty unique challenges. And so what I heard often was like, we need to be intentional about allocating funds specifically to this group and their support when they return, because it does become, you know, it's not just about the people leaving prison. It's about their families. It has a major ripple effect throughout an entire community when a person leaves prison and they don't have the effective supports they need to be successful. And particularly during a pandemic, when public health is of such great importance, we need to be making it as easy as possible for these folks to be following social distancing guidelines and doing what they need to do to stay safe and healthy, not only for themselves, but for the entire community.
This is Molly Bryant, and you just heard Emma Castleberry. She's a journalist based in Asheville, North Carolina. You can read her story about life after prison on bigiftrue.org. And this is Hard Reset. We're going to take a short break.
When we come back, we'll talk about a hard drive purported to belong to Joe Biden's son, Hunter, that many on the right, including President Donald Trump in the final presidential debate, claimed implicate Joe Biden in corrupt international dealings. That's right here on KXRW 99.9 FM in Vancouver, Washington.
Community radio like this is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at adco1.com. That's ADCO1.com.
KXRW would like to thank New Amsterdam for their ongoing support of our radio community. New Amsterdam is Vancouver's premier cannabis market for those 21 years of age and over. Visit newvamsterdam.com to view an order from the full online menu, and they now offer in-store, curbside, and touchless pickup to better serve you. New Amsterdam is located in the Heights Shopping Center on the corner of Mill Plain and Andreessen Road. Open 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., 365 days a year. More information available at...
All right, and we're back from break here on Hard Reset on KXRW 99.9 FM in Vancouver, Washington. Talking about October surprise of sorts, this story that originally came out in the New York Post not too long ago, talking about the hard drive from hell, as Rudy Giuliani has claimed. First of all, before we get into kind of the reaction of the story and a lot of the things around the story that deal with what we talk about on the show all the time, which is disinformation, social media, kind of how news spreads in the day and age we live in now, I want to talk about the story itself.
Yeah, Justin, actually, this is one that this Hunter Biden stuff, I have just dismissed it as salacious from the beginning. And so I haven't really followed this story at all. And so I'm really curious as to like what this is, what substance there is to it, how it really affects. I want to know if this is something that's really going to sway any undecided voters, or if there are undecided voters out there anymore. So
absolutely. So JC, I think you're getting right at the heart of it. What effect is this story really going to have on the election now that we're, you know, so close, you know, less than 2 weeks out? Really, I think there's a lot of reasons why this story maybe won't have the impact that some on the right, like President Trump, are hoping it's going to. I think a lot of people jump to associate this with like the WikiLeaks story of 2016. There are a few key differences. One of the major differences is the WikiLeaks, emails from Hillary Clinton and associates, campaign manager John Podesta. First of all, those were being talked about and starting to come out months before the election. Yes, in a way, they were kind of coming to a peak at this point in the cycle. But still, I think one major problem with this story, if you're thinking this is going to be something that changes the outcome on November 3rd, is that, you know, it came out so close to the election already, like we've been talking about on the show. Millions and millions of people are voting via early voting, mail-in ballots, absentee ballots. So any of those votes that are cast, obviously this story breaking late in the cycle isn't going to affect it. And they're also, I think, really, not to give credit to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange for whatever they did in 2016, but whatever you think about that story, I think this story is even more dubious and less credible. And the provenance of these materials the New York Post is reporting on are extremely murky. So basically, the source of the New York Post story is a hard drive that was given to a computer repair shop. I'll throw in an allegedly here because I'm not sure how confirmed that is, but only the New York Post and supposedly the FBI have had access to these materials. The FBI has not confirmed any of this, but the computer repair shop owner, who's a Trump supporter, has claimed that he's spoken with them about it, turned it all over to the FBI. So whatever the FBI is doing with this is unclear right now. We don't really know what role they play. What we do know is that at some point in the last year, the owner of this computer repair shop contacted Rudy Giuliani, or at least that's what is being told, the timeline, the way it worked out, and told him, hey, I have these laptops and these hard drives that Hunter Biden left at my shop and abandoned, and I think you need to check this stuff out. The actual materials on the hard drives, again, there's a lot of intrigue around what's there, what's been released, what's not been released. Some of the things that we know are there are screenshots of emails that talk about business dealings in Ukraine and allegedly China. I think Burisma is a Ukrainian energy company that a lot of people, at least that follow, you know, Trump world and the stories that they talk about a lot, will probably recognize the name Burisma. It was a Ukrainian energy company that Hunter Biden served on the board of. It's long been kind of like a code word or a way to talk about Biden's corruption in Ukraine specifically, but also just generally. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, President Trump talked about this in the presidential debate, basically saying like, Joe, you're a corrupt guy. You know, you took money from China, you took money from Ukraine. The actual proof of that is a lot more murky. We're talking about references using nicknames. Some say that they talk about holding money for the big guy in these emails, and that's supposedly Joe Biden. And again, none of these emails have been, you know, corroborated outside of the New York Post and Rudy Giuliani, who's kind of the sole source of these materials, as far as we know. Another thing that's very suspect here, some of the things that are purportedly on the hard drive, including pictures of Hunter Biden in compromising situations, using drugs, stuff like that. Lev Parnas, an associate of Rudy Giuliani, claims that in 2019, he and Rudy Giuliani were offered these pictures for sale for millions of dollars by people in Ukraine. So whether or not we trust Lev Parnas, who's, you know, was indicted as part of the scandals during Trump, President Trump's first term, I don't know. But I think there's enough weird details to the story beyond, you know, the computer repair shop and Rudy Giuliani, who we know, I mean, it's documented that Giuliani has been seeking dirt on Joe Biden for years at this point. That was kind of a part of the President Trump impeachment scandal, of course, was like Rudy Giuliani's actions overseas, trying to dig up dirt on the Biden family in Ukraine. So all of these things kind of come together in this New York Post story. And I think it's fair to say that the story is a little dubious in that respect. So that kind of led to the next phase in this whole narrative, which is Twitter and Facebook started taking actions to kind of quell the spread of the story, claiming that, you know, it hasn't been independently fact-checked. There are dubious claims, or the sources in the story maybe are dubious. And that, I think, is interesting. And, you know, we always talk about on the show, what is kind of the way forward when it comes to fake news and misinformation and the spread of things that can't be verified, masquerading as truth. And I think the idea of someone like Twitter, who actually went as far as banning the New York Post Twitter account and making the link impossible to share, that I think is an approach that maybe makes sense to a lot of people. What we see in this story was it really kind of backfired on Twitter, where, you know, we have this article from the MIT Technology Review that says that by banning the New York Post link, Twitter essentially doubled the amount of people that were going to see it. I think this is kind of famously referred to as the Streisand effect, where Barbara Streisand tried to suppress images of her beachfront house. And as a result, many, many more people ended up seeing those photos than would have otherwise.
Yeah, the controversy that it created made a lot more noise than the original thing.
Exactly.
And that's something that we've talked about even on the show here before, is the accidental amplification of this misinformation and just further muddying the waters while you're trying to clarify things.
Well, and I feel like I should mention that Twitter did kind of like backtrack a little bit, and they actually like changed their policy on hacked materials. But as far as, you know, this New York Post story is concerned, now that can be shared on the platform.
Yeah, and I think Jack Dorsey, the Twitter CEO, even said that it was a mistake that they banned the link. Like he said, you know, we regret doing that. So to your point, absolutely, they've backtracked.
Well, I think part of their concern is they did get a lot of criticism from Republicans, but they also got criticism from like whistleblower advocates who were concerned that like if there is material that needs to get out there and technically maybe it's hacked or, you know, leaked by a whistleblower, that they could be impacted by this Twitter policy. You know, it was supposed to like keep a handle on, you know, hacked material and not let it like proliferate on the platform. But you could see how that could, you know, not work out for a whistleblower.
Molly, as a journalist, you know, what do you think about this approach by Twitter to kind of, you know, the hack materials policy, I think makes sense, saying we're not going to allow people to publish hack materials on our platform. But is there any concern, like from a free speech perspective? And of course, Twitter is a private company. You know, it's not like an arm of the government that necessarily has to abide. But I think still, you know, in America, we kind of hope that even private platforms will kind of stick to the spirit of things like the First Amendment, right? So does it concern you at all that they would go so far as to ban the sharing of an article from, you know, maybe a tabloid, but still a news outlet like the New York Post? Or what was kind of your take on this whole thing?
No, because I mean, like, there were so many obvious problems that with their story that you kind of touched on earlier. And also, I feel like all of the stuff they've been doing, like they've been changing a lot of policies lately, the last month or so, in preparation of the election to supposedly like cut down on misinformation the month before the election. This stuff has been going on 4 years, and they've had 4 years since the last election to get a handle on this and come up with a solution that works. And instead, it's the month, you know, basically the October before election day, and they're coming up with all of these half measures. And you know what? It's too little, it's too late. It's way too late. That is the end of the show for today. Today's episode was hosted by JC Cortez and Justin Sanders. This episode was produced by me, Molly Bryant, and JC Cortez.
Our theme is Oh No by Hartle Road.
Hard Reset is available in podcast form on Apple Podcasts. If you like this show, you can find more of our content online.
Hard Reset is a podcast from bigiftrue.org. We're nonpartisan and nonprofit. You can find ways to support us at bigiftrue.org/support and subscribe to our newsletter at bigiftrue.org/hardreset.